Hi, my name is Debbie Kane. I'm from the Port City Council. I'm going to be chairing this meeting for you today. On the panel, we have got Graham Stringer on my left. He's on my right, sorry. He is a Member of Parliament for Brakeley and Broughton since 2010. Alison McGovern, she's the MP for Wirral South. And we've got Roger Cassell.
Cassali.
And he's the founder of Sierra of New Europeans. And then we've got Kyla, he is the Regional Outreach Officer for the Young Fabians Executive Committee. So let's just get on with it. Over to you, Alison,
Thanks everybody. It's really lovely to be here in Manchester. It pains me to say those words every time I'm here, being from Merseyside. But it is nonetheless, it's lovely to be here because I think that a lot of the debate about big European questions, a lot of our political debate often happens in London, actually not even in London, in Westminster, which is a very small part of London. And so I think that organisations like the Fabian Society, who actually are a network of members right across the country and who host events like this, are to be applauded, because it's no doubt that our politics is far too Westminster-centric, so it really is very good to be here. I'm not going to speak for a long time, not least because I had the pleasure of coming in to hear a bit of the last session at the end there, and Andy was saying so much that I agreed with that I'm going to try very hard not to just repeat what he said, but I just want to make a couple of introductory remarks about the question itself, which is a sort of slightly odd one for progressive, social democratic or socialists to be debating, which is about the EU and what's in it for me. It should obviously be what's in it for us. But I wanted to talk about Europe from the perspective of individual people in this country, and to just briefly give two caveats to my three reasons why I think the European Union has a huge amount to offer people in this country. So first, the caveats. The European Union isn't perfect, and neither are its institutions. And nothing that I say, nor my profound belief that I am a European, a pro-European, somebody who wants us to stay in Europe, none of that can get us away from the fact that the EU isn't democratic enough, it doesn't involve its citizens in its decision-making enough. And there are still far too many ways in which people feel that there's a bunch of powerful people at the top taking decisions over their heads. The reality is, though, all of the things I've just said about the European Union could equally be said of our own country. That's a fact about the way that power works in our world. It's not just a fact about the European Union. It's equally a fact about our country. And for every occurrence that I could cite of something undemocratic, irritating, or non-egalitarian that I could cite about the European Union's institutions, I could give you three about Westminster parliamentary democracy. So let's not congratulate ourselves too much. I'm not saying that Europe's in any way better or more successful. It's just that that on its own doesn't, I think, give us cause to want to leave. My second caveat is that there's been much discussion in recent weeks about David Cameron's renegotiation and what that means. If the European Union is far from perfect, our current Prime Minister doesn't even get close to perfection. And his renegotiation, sort of acceptable to me though it is, doesn't begin to capture some of the really important issues for us at the moment, whether it's the global refugee crisis that we ought to be helping Europe respond to, or problems in our industry, for example, our steel industry or the Greek economy. We should be working together to deal with those things, and David Cameron has singularly failed to do so. So despite those problems, I still believe that being in Europe offers each and every citizen of our country three things. I think it offers them work, ambition, and identity. And I'll just say something very, very briefly about those three things. I've heard Andy Burnham say many and oft that it would be hypocritical of us to object to people coming here to get a job when people from my region and his region of Merseyside did that in their thousands during difficult times. I think that the idea of free movement of labour goes way, way back. When my ancestors arrived poor and penniless in the docks of Liverpool, they were escaping famine and political unrest from a nearby European country of Ireland. This is our history, it's our heritage, and that sense that people will move around in order to provide a decent income for their family, I don't think is something that we'll ever turn away from. What we have to do is make that work well. But I think that young people in our country are interested in opportunities. And I think if I consider the experience that I've had working with global corporations like General Motors and Unilever, the idea that people will move around for work is something that is as much part of what people see their working lives being about now as it ever has been. Secondly, on ambition, I think it's really important that we don't turn away from actually what Europe has offered people in terms of quality of life and the ambition that they have for themselves. And when in the 1990s, my home city of Liverpool and this city of Manchester needed investing in, it wasn't the British government who kick-started that process, it was the European Union through structural funds. People had a sense of ambition for their cities that Europe helped deliver on. And lastly, our identity. I said at the beginning that I consider myself to be a European, and I do. I consider myself to be English, to be from Merseyside, but I consider myself to be profoundly British, and I think that's how a lot of people feel. And the question I ask myself is, what does it mean to be British right now? What is that identity all about? Well, I think more than anything else, it's about showing leadership to the world. It's about saying where there are problems that cross borders, being British is about stepping forward and wanting to do something about it. And I think that's both part of being British and part of being a social democrat or a progressive who wants to see life chances improve for people. What greater leadership could we offer people in this country than being a part of Europe and demonstrating that we're prepared to think big, to have ambition, and to show leadership to the rest of our continent? For all of those reasons, I think that there is something in it for all of us to stay European.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Alison. Can it's your turn now, Graham?
All right. Thanks very much. One of the things I get marginally irritated about in these debates, which I've done a lot of over the last 6 to 8 months, is the substitution of Europe for EU. I sort of love the culture of Europe. One can go through the sort of great composers, novelists, whatever. I'm very much part of that culture, just as I rather like sort of French and Spanish cuisine and their wines. That is not the EU, and I think it is wrong in the debates to sort of say that somehow being pro-EU is being pro-European. It's not, it's being pro a particular organisation. The specific question that is asked in this debate, and what lies behind that question, really, is it possible to reform the EU? Because one of the interesting things in all the debates I go to, whether it's people from the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, or the Lib Dem Party who want to stay within the European Union, it is that it's not perfect, as Alison says, and I would certainly agree with that, but we can reform it. There is a question that follows that.
Where is the evidence?
That it is reformable. If one looks at what the Prime Minister has done over the last few months, he is holding, or was holding in his hand, a major ace. This country, in the time of every British Parliament, in gross terms, commits £100 billion to the EU. Some of it comes back, and so it's less than that now, but it's about two-thirds of that. That's an important consideration. We also are a major part of the discussions. There is a real possibility that the European Union will fall apart if the United Kingdom leaves, because the desire that there has been in this country to have a referendum exists in many of the other European countries as well, and many of the Dutch and the French and maybe some of the other countries may also want a referendum. What the sort of rather arrogant Commission call contagion is something I would call democracy, giving people the right to decide. So with all that in his hand to negotiate with, he's come back with a rather unpleasant deal that means that workers working next to each other will get different benefit levels and a bureaucratic mess with 27 different benefit levels. An absolute insult to parliamentary democracy, where he says, well, if the United Kingdom Parliament can get the agreement of whatever it is, 12 other parliaments, if we can go around and persuade the Estonians and the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Slovenians and the Dutch and the Germans or whoever, if you can get to 12, then the Commission will think again about whether it is a good idea to implement this policy. How extraordinarily arrogant. I believe that a democracy is defined. I don't believe the European Union is, it's not just an imperfect democracy, like all democracies are imperfect. It is not really a democracy. Because in a democracy, those people who make the laws and those people who set the taxation levels, it has been a fundamental part of the argument for democracy since the Enlightenment, that those people, the rascals, as the Americans call them in 19th century elections, should be able to be thrown out. That the electorate should be able to throw those people out. And they cannot. So it's not a democracy. I don't think it's reformable. Most of the things that people are concerned about are deep within the international agreements that set up the European Union, the treaties. They're not going to be changed because you now need the agreement of 28 countries. So although I agree with Alison that people from this country have gone abroad to work and people come here to work, and the idea that this would stop or that trade would stop if we left the EU is just wrong. But the part of being a sovereign country is to decide who can come here. The reason your ancestors and my ancestors came here from Ireland was because they were part of the same country, actually. And that we have always been able to, until we joined the EEC and the EU, decided who can come here. We need some people to come here. There are two stupid positions on migration. Having no controls whatsoever and saying nobody can come in. Those are two stupid positions. But my constituents in North Manchester are threatened by having their wages, their conditions undercut on a regular basis, and having people from countries that are much poorer than ours, effectively open migration, from over 500 million people, and because some of those countries are corrupt and recognised as being corrupt, like Croatia and Hungary, you can buy effectively passports to come into this country. I think that's a bad thing and my it's bad for my constituents, and I don't think that's a particularly reactionary thing to say. The final thing I would want to say, that somehow, well, it's not two final things really, is that somehow we're part of a prosperous organisation. The question for people in on the left that they have to answer really is the point that the Prime Minister regularly makes. Why has this country been able to produce more jobs than the whole of the rest of the European Union since the recession? This body that people claim is so prosperous has actually demolished the employment opportunities for the youth across the whole of Southern Europe, where there is 50% employment all round about in Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, Cyprus. The Commission, the European Central Bank, the IMF have pursued ultra factorised policies, and in supporting the EU, we have supported that. And that's not an accident, it's not reformable, it's a direct result of putting the political priorities of political union above that generation of young workers. And the very final point I would want to make, people talk about not just the prosperity, which is self-evidently not there, but they talk about working together. The EU is not about working together. I work with Alison in the Parliamentary Labour Party, people in the Labour Party work together. That's working together. I do not work with the Conservatives. The Conservatives at the moment have a majority, and they impose that majority on those of us who disagree with what they're doing. We did exactly the same thing when we were in government, and that is precisely what happens within the European Union. In the 72 times this country, our country, has put things to the vote in council meetings, 72 times we've lost, and one can put similar but much higher figures together about the European Parliament. So it isn't about working together, it's being part of a political body where we're often in a minority and this country's interests get squashed. And I suppose that is the real issue. Do you believe that there is a national interest that we can pursue and we can win arguments against the Tories, or do you believe we are better protected by handing over power to an unelected body rather than fighting the Tories and winning our own policies in this country? Thank you.
Thank you, Graham.
Excuse me, can I possibly ask if the speakers could go over there? Just because, I don't know what's like with them, but for us, you keep going in and out of the light.
Put shame in your eyes, actually.
I don't know whether it's one for you as well. It's really distracting
because
your mouth
is
going
down with the mic. Sorry, Mark. Are they on?
Sorry.
Are they on then? Microphones? Is that okay?
I'm very happy to
get it. Is that okay? Yeah, turn that off.
Oh, all right.
Turn that off.
Yeah. Would you
want to go into that? Oh, right. Okay. Paula?
I'm actually quite pleased that I'm at the lectern because it means my shirt can be untucked. I don't worry about that. I just didn't hold my notes on, which is ideal. Before I start talking about Europe, I'd just like to thank Alison Kaylee for organising this and anyone else who organised it that wasn't visible to me. I really appreciate being invited. The Young Fabians have lots of people like myself who'd love to come and speak at any event. So if you do need a speaker or something, by all means, give us an email. So I'm quite keen to get involved in the should we stay or should we leave the EU debate that's kind of developed as one would expect given we've got a referendum on the moment. But I'm going to try and stick for the purpose of this speech broadly to what forms I think the EU should commit to in the long term. And maybe I'll get a chance to address it when some of the questions are asked, if there are fairly obvious implications of my position. Suffice for now, though, to say that I think that Remain is going to win, and I think that Remain is going to win comfortably. So my main concern is how can we move the debate about Europe from the slightly poisonous, not useful at all, either you love it or you hate it, to how we think it should be different, given that it is going to exist. And I say it is going to exist in some form or other, whether we leave EU or not, we have to have some kind of bilateral treaties with the European Union or with other countries, organisations or multiple organisations that do the same role as the EU are always going to exist. We need to look at how we best manage those. So my points are applicable in that scenario as well, though, like I say, it's not likely to happen. So, broadly speaking, I'm a socialist. I may be a Fabian gradualist, ultra-pragmatist socialist, but I am. So the kind of policies that I would like the EU to look forward to in the future would be things like cracking down on tax avoidance, things like leaving the door open for governments to pursue an industrial policy which had more government intervention, things like guaranteeing, maybe not the same minimum wage, but some kind of minimum wage standards across the European Union, things like compelling governments to ensure that there are houses available that are genuinely affordable. I don't think these things are going to happen anytime soon. We are a million miles away from the moment. Certainly the government that we currently have is not going to lobby for any kind of progressive change. Even when we were in power, we often opposed some of these changes because we saw them as an imposition on our sovereignty, and we also thought that they would be unpopular. And we're also not going to get to them because, as I say, the discourse is currently either you are either pro or anti-EU. It is incredibly polarised. So what I would like to concentrate on are reforms that would generate a level of public consent for the institution of the European Union, so we can move beyond that particular argument. But also because, by definition, as you'll see from my speech, those rules will give the public more power, more influence, and more ability to shape the laws so that they are in the interests of, say, British families, which is you'll see if you read the programme, is one of the key things we're supposed to be addressing today. So I want to look at three main areas. The first is the most important issue to most people, regrettably in some ways, immigration. Now, Andy has said lots of the things that I was going to say exactly as I was going to say them already. So if you were there for his speech, you will have heard that. What I would echo is that it is incredibly important to, while thinking something is overall good, and while making the case that it is overall a good thing, recognise that there are problems. The Labour Party exists to solve problems like those, the problems of the people that are negatively affected by immigration. And we should be not only trying incredibly hard to solve those, and lobbying at a European level to have things like hardship funds, whereby if services are being overwhelmed by a recent influx of people arriving in an area, this happened a lot in Southampton. It was a massive issue in the election there. There were a lot of Labour switches to UKIP. But there are funds available to increase the capacity of services in those areas. I think it is also reasonable to say that if we are not going to pay benefits to a family that lives, say, in Romania, if that family were to move here, it does not seem reasonable that they immediately are entitled to all the benefits that someone who has paid into the British system for a long time would get. I think that we do have obligations to people all across the world, but I don't think those obligations start and end on a line on a map. And if we are going to have public consent for an institution that has some governing role of the whole of Europe, we do need to listen to what they are saying. It doesn't affect a large number of people, but it makes a massive difference to what you hear what you hear on the doorstep. If you have, for example, a council that prioritises housing based on how long people have been in the country. So that's the first thing I would say. Second, I would say, structurally, the EU is not the most democratic of institutions. I think that's fair. There is a level of democracy, but we should have more. I do not see a reason why the President of the European Commission should not be directly elected. The European Parliament should have executive ability to introduce legislation. And what's more, if we were to do that, people would suddenly start caring a lot more about European Parliament elections. Apparently something like 30% of people in this country voted, 30% of the electorate, not even 30% of people, it's much less than that, voted in those elections. That is not on. We can remedy that very easily by giving them more power. And further, I think we need to have a level of party and political organisation on a pan-European level. So one of the things the Young Fabians is currently doing is trying to affiliate with the Party of European Socialists. And the reason we want to do that is so we can work more closely with our counterparts in the rest of the EU, so that we understand the issues that are affecting their country, and we can better explain to the people of the UK why the EU and why other our European partners do what they do. What are the big issues that affect them? Say, for example, in Malta, there is... Malta, just make sure I have got that right, because I don't want to accuse the Maltese of getting a fuss over something. Yeah, well, apparently, in Malta, there's currently a massive controversy over the plug spanner industry, right? So, if you see a large amount of regulations going through Europe in the future, affecting that area, you will understand why. Now, we assume that everything is about us, and we need to stop doing that, because we get puzzles to why things aren't happening instantly. Well, there's a lot of things that a lot of people want, and if we can involve people much more in that process and get them to understand that much better, I think that people will be less aggressively resistant to lots of the things the European Union does. So that's what I wanted to say now. I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
So it's Roger Kasavi. Like many of my previous incarnations, was the Labour MP for Wimbledon. So I know a tough campaign when I see one. But I am now the chief executive of an organisation called New Europeans, which is a platform for mobile EU citizens. And we're a Europe-wide organisation. Are there any mobile EU citizens in the room? I know there are a lot in Manchester. Yes. Don't be afraid. I think I've still got a little bit more time because I was asked really to, of course, I'll do my homework and answer the questions, which I'll come to right at the end, but also to say something about the campaign and also about the work the New Europeans is doing in the context of the campaign, which is a little bit different to what's going on with Stronger In, but complementary to it. I congratulate you all for being, because all of us being here, because I think we're already veterans of this campaign. I know it's a big sort of historic campaign it is, but we've got 4 months to go, and it's going to be like the last week. It's going to be a tough go. I remember Ed Wajewicz saying that when the referendum comes, we're going to be invited as a nation to decide whether we hate migrants more than we love business, or the other way around. There's a lot that can be said about migration, but in this context of Fabian Society, I'll just say, remember, free movement is something that is linked to the single market, so even if we're not a member of the European Union, we'll still be one single market. And with the single market come freedom of movement of goods, services, capital, and freedom of movement of people. And I don't see how, from a left-wing perspective or a left or centre perspective, we can champion freedom of movement of goods and services and capital and not freedom of movement of people. And the other thing I want to say is do have a look at our website, neweuropeans.net, because I was a little bit disappointed to hear Andy say, I'm sorry he's not here to defend himself, but he can put this out on Twitter saying he might be able to follow up on Twitter. There actually isn't evidence for the kind of abuses that he was talking about. We've done a lot of work around the country with communities, and the evidence actually isn't there, but maybe this will come in after discussion. Although, to be fair, he did say a lot of things about the contribution that migrants make as well. But equally, I think that there is an issue with the business side that I think sometimes the numbers get exaggerated, because we will still be in the single market. So it's interesting, actually, that I think anyway, that's another debate. So what I want to say is, well, I think it's very interesting, and we're interested very much in this in Europe, because we anticipated that the debate would move in this direction, away for a little bit from migration and macroeconomics, onto this question of identity and democracy. It's interesting that Graham's been talking a lot about democracy. And I was debating with Stephen Wolfe the other day, who is the UKIP migration MEP. And he's talking now not about us being overrun by an invasion of Bulgarians and Romanians, but he's talking about the Chartists and the Leftists and even the suffragettes. So I got up and I said, look, okay, what you want to do is actually you want to take people's rights away. I don't understand why people come into politics to take people's rights away, but some people do. They want to take the rights of our friend over there and all of us to free movement to Europe. They want to take that away. That's their political mission. And they do it now in the name of democracy. And they call the Chartists in it. But I said, you know, don't do that, please. And certainly do not dare to call the suffragettes in aid of this movement. But this is where we are at the moment. But I didn't need to worry about this too much either, because this is, we need to remember, we need to put this in perspective. This is a politician's debate. Graham knows, I mean, I remember when I was in Parliament, and I've been waiting for this moment for years and years and years, for a generation. But nobody asked for this referendum. People didn't ask for this referendum. I mean, if you ask them, do you want a referendum, most people say yes. If you say, we'll give you a referendum, give us a list of 10 things you want a referendum, Europe wouldn't be on the list. But now, the people have to decide. And as Martin Walsh said, you know, it is possible that a combination of xenophobia and political incompetence, because it is political incompetence that we've got to this point, and the economic circumstances, and Graham's referred to the terrible unemployment in Greece, but I think if everybody was in a job in Greece, I don't think Graham would change his position on the European Union, but we'll talk about that in the questions. But there are lots of problems, let's face it. Yeah. And so it's now that people have to decide. And my problem with this is that I think that a lot of things I've heard here today in other debates, I think that's fine, you know, for us in this room. But it's not going to convince anybody who hasn't made their mind up. And this referendum is not going to be decided by anybody really in this room. It's not going to be decided by a friend who's in their money uses it because you won't have the bet, that's my smile, best effort. It's going to be decided by people who not only haven't decided yet, haven't actually started thinking about it yet. And they don't know how they should think about it. And they switch on their television and they hear Richard Danner telling them what's good for them. Or they hear somebody else telling them what's good for them. And they don't know. They haven't got a PhD in macroeconomics or subsidiarity. How are they supposed to make their mind up? So what we want to be doing is to try to actually give people the opportunity in communities around the country. We're doing something called Community Voices, where we actually go and we facilitate conversations about what it actually means to be a citizen of Europe, what the European Union means to me. Actually, I think the other side is not terribly interested in this issue of the international relationship between Britain and the European Union. They're interested in what the European Union means to me. So I've got a young Bulgarian who lives with me at the moment. His father was run over. He works at Cafe Nero, doing a great job. His father was run over last week in Bulgaria. He needs to fly back to see him. He can do that. He's got a week's family, special family leave, thanks to the European Union. Now, the European Union is not going to have free movement of labour and let Ivan come here without giving him a little bit of protection if something goes wrong. But that protection for him is there for all of us. We've all got that. So there are lots and lots of things where Europe means something to me. And I think this needs to come out. I think the most powerful voices are not the ones on this platform or anybody else. They're the people who we meet. And that in these conversations that we have, whether it's with the Women's Institute or the Royal National Institute for the Deaf, whoever it is, people talk to each other and share their experiences. And we have to validate people. Some people don't like the EU, and they've got no reasons not to like it. But equally, it doesn't mean to say that that's right for everybody. They have different points of view. For some people, the EU means freedom and opportunity. For others, it means, you know, capitalism, corporatism, but let's have a conversation. Everybody has their own view about it. But when somebody speaks up, who's your neighbour, or somebody in the workplace, and says, well, actually, my daughter went on an Erasmus project, or actually this happened, or actually I was in Spain, and my parents have retired to Spain, and they're getting free healthcare there. This is something that's going to be meaningful to people and help them to decide. So I'm really conscious of time. So this is what we're trying to do. Let me just at the end then, and I hope perhaps you'll ask some more questions about it, because I think in the end, people have got to come to their own view about this. And I don't think they're going to be asked to choose between British identity and European identity. I think we're both. When we had the referendum in Scotland, did we all go up there and say you have to choose between being Scottish and being British? Or did we go there and say you're Scottish and British? So why can't we say at the moment we're British and European? Why can't we say that? We're not saying that, but we are. And that European identity and citizenship counts for something. And people need to discover what it means for themselves in the context of their own lives. They're fed up of being talked to and want to be listened to. which is a reason for me to shut up. So let me just say very briefly then on the question to David Cameron's deal. Most of it were things that didn't need the threat of a referendum to be negotiated. Yeah. There's a constant reform process going on, some of the economic stuff. Don't tell anybody, but the free movement thing is not really a restriction of free movement at all. So, but let's not shout out from the rooftops. I'm not telling anybody because it'll just get used to it. In any way, I think the things will be wrong. I don't think people, the undecideds, are going to look at the details of the Brussels deal or whatever it was and decide on that basis. I think what's a pity is that British influence is at such a low ebb. The way we behaved is ridiculous. We've always had special status. I think from a European perspective, which is what I think, I mean, I was embarrassed for the way that the British were behaving. I think we had a long time before we recover our influence, which is a pity. But I don't think that's anything to worry about. I think making Europe real for people, there have been a lot of speeches about that. You can go on our website, TUC website, there's plenty and plenty of material. But we've got to find out what sort of question was preaching to people. It's a question of giving people access to that information. It's a huge information deficit. When you listen to these debates on the TV, always the audience will say, we don't know anything about it because we haven't done that work. We can do that, but we're in government. We haven't done that work over generations. People haven't got time between now and the 23rd of June to get a PhD in the European Union. We've got to get information to them that's relevant to them, help them discover it and share it. And the third thing is really the thing I want to focus on is the EU fit for purpose. The EU's done a lot of great things, but we have to face the future. It isn't a question about comparing the first half of the 20th century with the second half. Well, that's a good comparison to make, but actually what we need to do is compare the 20th century with the 21st century. And we're a family. I don't think you can say I like Europe and I don't like the European Union, because the European Union is the way we organise ourselves in Europe, for the benefit of the citizens of Europe. It's in Europe, we can get away with that. And Europe is facing a crisis. I think Europe is facing the biggest crisis since the Second World War. And we have to think what we're going to do about the refugee crisis, and what that means in terms of us being Europeans. Is Europe just about being free movement, or is it actually about being responsible and showing solidarity and responding on the basis of our values? And I think we do need more Europe. We need more, but we need more solidarity, we need more equality, we need more liberty, and we need to keep building. But whereas you had someone like Winston Churchill in 1946 speaking to crowds in Zurich and saying we need to, Europe needs to unite, today we haven't got any statesmen like that. We have to do that. We have to grow up. We have to stand up and say we are the citizens of Europe. And we want a Europe that does this and that does better. But in any family, in Europe as a family, you have a moment of crisis. And Europe isn't responding to the economic crisis. It isn't responding. It isn't. There's lots and lots of things. But let's not throw it away and start again. Let's not be a fair weather friend of Europe. Let us think about our own responsibility as individuals and take charge and use the little democracy is there and build on it and go further. But let's not walk away and turn our backs, not on history, but on our future. Our future. Me, you, and everybody in this room, and our children, grandchildren, and work, and remain in the European Union. Thank you.
What I propose is that if we take questions from the floor, but rather than the panel stand up there, because we'd be there all day getting everyone to stand up, if everyone can just sit down, would that be okay? So we're not blocking the light. So first question to this gentleman. I'll take it in groups of four. I'll start with you and the gentleman at the back. No women? No all women?
I'll speak for longer.
Okay. The gentleman in the blue shirt. Oh, this woman here. And the gentleman at the back there with the...
Thank you. Like Alison, I feel European. I'm a British European. But many of you talk about, want to ask about your opinions about why it is that, including from the panel, and the previous panel, but around Britain generally, you hear criticism of the European Union institutions being undemocratic. Now, I'm far from a person who would suggest that the EU institutions are perfect or that there's a lot of reform, and I agree with the point being made, there's a strong case for the President of the European Commission being directly elected. But that's not another point. But you do hear a lot of people still talking about the European Commission legislating. Now, the one thing the European Commission has no power at all to do is to legislate. Legislation goes through Parliament, which is elected, our MEPs, and through the Council, which is the Council of Ministers of the democratically elected governments. So to suggest that the European Union is undemocratic is nonsense. And I work a lot at European level, and my colleagues in other continental countries find when someone from Britain with its House of Lords suggests that the European Union are undemocratic, they think it's hilariously funny. And that's the first one I'll make. And the second one, I agree entirely with what Andy had to say about the emotional case. It's very important. We have to work on that. But I do hope that we will think about some of the serious policy issues as well. I mean, my area is public health and the environment. Now, we need to remember that air blows in the wind and water flows where it flows. And we can't, in a small country, control that. We need to control the environment as we need to at continental level. It's quite rightly a European competence. The EU has had some great successes in controlling the environment, and its activities on climate change put the present government in the UK to shame. And I hope we can continue to support you to do that. And similarly, in public health, I won't say much about that, but just to give you one simple example, how absurd would it be when we're concerned about control of communicable disease around the world to shut ourselves off from the European Union?
we need to know the question.
From European Centre for Disease Control.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Gentleman, the black and the blue jumper.
I just wanted to ask a question about the confusion of reform and integration. A very respected voice on the issue of the European Union, Timothy Garvin-Ash, wrote an article in which he attributed the economic crisis in the Eurozone and the rest of the European Union, as well as a political crisis of confidence amongst European member states. He attributed that to the lack of integration in Europe. Europe has got monetary integration in the Eurozone, and some levels of legal, political integration, but they've got no fiscal integration and not enough political integration for the European integration project to work. So my question is, in the context of talking about EU reform, to what extent does that mean to you on the panel, deeper integration, which is suggested by many academics as the only solution for a successful, prosperous European integration project? And similarly, to what extent can a vote to remain in June be interpreted as explicit consent by Britain to deep integration?
Thank you. And it was the woman in the purple scarf.
Hello. So currently Britain is not part of the Schengen area. And the two biggest countries that have access to the free market without being part of the EU, Norway and Switzerland, have Schengen. They had to agree to have Schengen to have access to the common market. So I suppose my question is that can we possibly have an accurate conversation about immigration in Britain and the EU if we won't admit that actually if we leave the EU, the deal that we negotiate with Europe, the EU, will probably involve actually possibly greater freedom of movement than we have now, because actually Norway has greater freedom of movement than we do, and they pay a comparable amount of money into the European budget, and they have no say in how it's spent. So if you're concerned about democracy and the EU, how can it possibly be fair to say that if we left the EU and still had to contribute to its budget, that would be more democratic for us to have no voice and pay more money, potentially?
Thank you. And the man at the back with the check shares.
I think it's with the EU is, in terms of this country, in terms of the environment, the Tories don't care about the environment, and it's only the EU that is helping it there. To terms of our national security, I think it's the EU which is going to involve anything rather than fighting on NATO. But I think in terms of democracy, I think we saw Greece elected the most left-wing government that Europe's ever seen. And now they've had to impose the right-wing cuts that Europe has ever seen. I mean, what does that mean for the EU? I mean, has the EU given a thumbs up to austerity? And how does that affect the left in proposing a different alternative economy?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. So we'll start with you, Roger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, people haven't said their names. So I spoke for long, so I'll just be very short. What I like about all of the responses is that we're starting to speak now about, not what the British are saying or not, but about what kind of Europe we want. Mm-hmm. And this is the conversation we need to have, as we heard earlier on. And the information deficit works both ways. I think the politicians in Europe, actually I know from when I was in Parliament, there's an information deficit. People don't actually know and act on what the real needs of citizens are. I'll give you an example. The roaming charges. Why have we got lower roaming charges? I know the European institutions would say, we did this, the Commission covered ourselves in glory. Well, that took a long time to do it, didn't they? And it wasn't until we had the instrument of the European Citizens Initiative, and we had seven different countries and others getting towards a million signatures, well, they didn't get anywhere near a million signatures, actually, which is what you need to get on the agenda. The Commission saw it coming, thought, oh, okay, we better do something, and they did. So the institutions do respond. We need to have things going much more that way around. I moved from Wimbledon to Putney, and in Putney High Street, if anybody knows it in London, it's the worst spot for air pollution. It's the bottom of the hill and all the air collects there. If we didn't have European environmental regulation, we'd be completely, you know, we'd be much worse than we are. So we'd have air quality levels that would kill even more people than they already do in London. I don't know what it's like here. Nobody goes on about red tape, but that's a bit of red tape that I want. Coming here was a taxi driver, and he's talking to him about Europe, and he said, you know, went on about red tape. And then he started talking to me about the Uber thing and the black cabs. Mm-hmm. And then as I got out of the cab, he said, oh, we've got to get those politicians to do something about the black cabs. You mean you won't get them to do regulations? He said, oh, you mean red tape? So we started with the taxi driver saying about how he hated red tape, and we ended it talking about how much he loves it. Because red tape depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about social rights, then we want red tape. If we're talking about the environment, we want it. So, yes, the free movement, we will have even more free movement if we're out than if we're in. So that is correct. Unless we have the Nigel Lawson approach, which is to come out of the single market as well. Nobody would be economic suicide, but fortunately that's not the debate we're having. But it is, yeah, I don't know. I'm not somebody standing here saying we must have more European integration. Juncker said more Europe, more union. Yeah, more Europe in this union, more union in this union. What I say, what Europeans say, let's have more equality in this union. Let's have more solidarity in this union. Let's have something that works for the citizens. And by the way, that's not just for the institutions of the European Union, it's also local government and national government. If you look at UKIP, they use the same arguments in the local government elections as they do in the European ones. It's all the same narrative, it's all the same, they're wreckers. It just works a bit better with the European Union because people don't really know about it. It's too far away, it's too complicated, so people have a tendency to believe them. And one final thing, that our friend at the River isn't there by the EU citizen, you have a vote in the regional elections and in the local elections, thanks to the European Union. Use it and ask candidates, you won't have votes for the referendum, but ask the candidates who are standing, including Labour candidates, if they're from Labour Leave, are you somebody who is trying to get Britain out of the European Union and take away my right to free movement? Is that what your intention is? They're not going to be, even if they get out, they won't succeed, but that is absolutely their intention. And they need to be held to account for it, and you can do that. So register to vote, and ask your candidates, use your voice to challenge your candidates on where they are with this, and make it real for them, bring it down to earth. Look at me, say, I'm here, I'm a mobile EU citizen, you're creating a lot of anxiety and uncertainty for me. Is that really what you intend to do? And if not, then stop it.
Can I ask the panel to just shorten the answers a little bit? Because I don't want to go out. If you can, just shorten the answers because we really do need to get on. I would like to ask some more questions to the floor. So over to you, Graham.
I shorten the answers. I think that those countries that are part of the euro, they will inevitably have to integrate further. You've got monetary union. It is a complete nonsense to have monetary union without banking union and fiscal union. So I think those countries will integrate much more than they have done in the past. I don't see that there's any political party in this country that wants to reverse the decision to stay out of the EU. And there lies a threat to us, because whatever safeguards Cameron thinks he's brought back, if you have a lot of countries with old fiscal, banking, monetary union, they will come to similar conclusions on things, and we will be inevitably in a minority. And in one sense, I've always thought that the real choice was for this country was to go as a whole hog and get into there or leave, because we will be repressed if we're in that, and I'm obviously for the leaving, if we're in that situation. In terms of the Greek argument and reform, I tried to make it in the introductory remarks. The hierarchy of priorities that the European political project has is the most important, is that integration. So although there could have been different policies applied to Greece from the very beginning, not letting them join the euro because they didn't comply with the rules as they should have been, their current deficit, was higher than allowed it, that they will pursue those policies to the detriment of workers. And the point I was trying to make about prosperity was that it is an illusion that a Europe with those priorities will lead to greater prosperity. The European Union, or European continent, is the it has the least growth, has done worse economically over the last 6 or 7 years compared to any of the other continents on planet. I'll say one thing about the environment, and I won't try and answer the other points, although there are answers to them. I don't really share this sort of rose-tinted view of Europe being good on the environment. The sort of appalling way they've implemented the carbon charges, wrecking, having a zero price effectively for carbon, which has transferred lots of money into some industries, while putting the cost of fuel up in other industries, has effectively transferred a lot of European industry into other countries without helping the climate in any way whatsoever. And if you look at the latest scandal of the exhaust coming out of Volkswagen cars, what's really interesting is that the capitalist North America, the United States, are able to prosecute and will almost certainly win huge compensation against Volkswagen and maybe some other in the European Union, because the European Union is subject to major lobbyists from BMW, Volkswagen, and other car companies. We will not be able to prosecute them here. And those appalling tests that this country tried to get changed are actually poisoning people. So I do not agree that the European Union has been good for the environment. There is this theoretical argument that, you know, we all live in the same planet, therefore we should all have a very big government. In practice, the EU has been appalling.
Thank you, Graham. Okay,
I'm going to try and be really brief. So for those people who just made excellent remarks, for example, on Schengen and Norway, I will just say, quite right. It's about the balance that we want to have. And also on the kind of democratic question. I think sometimes when we think about democracy, we confuse the process and the practice. So we confuse whether what makes democracy work, the structure, or whether it's the practice of the politicians involved in it. And I think whilst structure is really important. Actually, it's the practice we should focus on. Being an MEP is an incredibly tough job, I'm sure, but I think that probably some of our MEPs are really good at making sure that people feel involved and engaged, as I do a lot of work with our regional MEPs who do, and perhaps others aren't so good. And there is a way of improving democracy in investigating and interrogating how we can have better democratic practice. But the issue I wanted to, I could talk for hours on the environment and what might make that work, but the issue that I felt that two people raised that I just wanted to make a couple of comments on was this issue of the European economy. Graham's made several allusions to like Europe as being not a prosperous place. Well, prosperity is, you know, a relative term. And when I was in Kenya as the Shadow International Development Minister, talking to Kenyan businesses about how we could improve fair trade and the fair trade links between our consumers and their producers, what they wanted to talk to me was about what they could learn from the European Union in that part of Africa and how they could build up their prosperity by improving trade links and also being a bigger block to talk to countries like ours. So it is all relative. And to come to the sort of real nub of it, and whether or not the euro is imperfect, I would say, well, we're sort of asking ourselves, what's the perfect single currency area? And we decided quite rightly that our economy wasn't right for the euro. I think that was obviously the right decision. And you can argue for each individual European country whether, you know, they are perfectly part of a currency area. If you want to have a single currency area, then you need to deal with inequalities in that single currency area. So the question we should ask ourselves is, why hasn't there been more reform of the economies within Europe that are weak? And the answer to that is a political answer. And I suppose my frustration would be that we need to be part of that discussion, working with progressives in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, to figure out how to reform and improve their economies so that that single currency area works. I think that's part of the kind of British leadership that I would like to see. You know, we can all sort of from afar judge whether Germany, France and others have done the right thing or not. But I think that it's far better to be engaging with those countries and using our partnerships across our sister political parties to be part of that discussion and hopefully a helpful part. Not least because the one bit of our economy that is really affected is financial services. And, you know, the moment where we had a massive crisis in that economy, our country did demonstrate serious leadership to try and sort out the problems in our financial services, which, by the way, are still not over or dealt with. And I think that we need to make sure that we don't see this as a kind of like moment for us to be judging other people's economic problems and say, well, lads, you know, you've brought this on yourselves. And frankly, we're just going to, you know, take further steps out because we just don't want to be a part of this mess. We are a part of the European economy. And the question I think we have to ask ourselves is, how do we, especially in reforming and improving financial services, how do we show British leadership about making our whole, the economy across our continent and all of our countries more equal and gives everybody a more equal chance of success?
Thanks, Alison. Kyla?
Okay, so I'll just briefly address the example of Norway first, because you know, I think that's a particularly pertinent example. A few years ago, the Norwegian Parliament did a report. It was a 900-page report, it was all areas of policy, and they found that EU regulations affected almost everything that their government did. It was three quarters of all EU legislation was directly incorporated into Norwegian law, and they have literally no say over what it is at all. They have higher immigration, as I think was mentioned, than the UK does. And the report concluded that while the EU membership of the European Economic Area had been beneficial to Norway overall, it had been calamitous, that was the direct translation that I read, it was calamitous for democracy. So Norway is, yes, a particularly good example of what we might be like if we were to leave the European Union while still trying to preserve any semblance of a productive economy for the next 10 years. Secondly, the issue that the gentleman at the front raises about democracy, I agree that the EU is democratic, but the problem is it doesn't feel democratic, right? And I think the reason for that is because it's not obvious how you get change. So, like, partly this is why I was talking about parties integrating much more across Europe or listening to each other. We need to build a consciousness about European issues so that we can work together, socialist parties or conservative parties or whoever it is, in different countries, to give people a clear idea of how they can get that change. And just to pick up on what Alison was saying, I'm sure the MEPs are working very hard to inform people, but they don't really have very much support, right? They have an MEP office budget, right? But they don't have a party infrastructure behind them taking their case to the country. We don't want to give them all of the Labour Party's money, but we probably should help them a bit more. And on your other point about the Centre for Disease Control, I think this is a broader point here, which is that it is fine to set all of these things up in the first place, and you can probably get other people to get on board with you. But to leave all of them at once in a massive rejection of European identity, and then say that you want to try and set them up, or play an active role in them, will be almost impossible. So the difference between setting them up in the first place from scratch and leaving and then trying to set them up is, I think, particularly significant. So I completely agree with your point. And finally, on Greece and the way they were treated. Look, I think it was appalling. It was appalling on a moral level because of the suffering that's happened in Greece. Food aid was being handed out. You had gangs of thugs going around murdering people who didn't conform to societal standards of how they should act. You know, disabled people, homosexuals, things like that. That they nearly had a fascist coup. And more importantly, well, not more importantly, but equally, it was economically ridiculous. It wasn't in the interest of anyone to act that way. The reason that happened was not, however, because of the EU and its corrupt institutions. Mm. It was because the voters in the countries that Greece owed money to did not want to bail them out, right? And that would have happened whether Greece was in the EU or not, and it would have happened whether the EU was involved at all or not. So it's simply unreasonable to hold the EU accountable for that particular incident.
Thanks, Kylo. I think that's all we've got time for now. We've ran over because Andy Burnham talked too much.
There's a tea break, so we'll be back at 4:15 for the last session.
Thank you, everyone.
That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think so. That should be fine.
That's
yeah,
fun.
Can you get water?
Take my glass.
Yeah?
Have you got all of us?
Thanks. I'll send it to you. Send it out to my mother. Thank you.
Hello. Hello, everyone. I don't agree with you, but at least you're consistent. I would be the very baddest by me. We're too timid, or perhaps we're too nice. Just say we're not giving you the bit. We are not giving you the bit.
I cannot admit
which we can do.
Our little power.
Don't even comment on it, it's not worth it. Well, it's nothing to do with the crash.
Ready?
It's nothing to do with the crash. Oh, okay. It's all good fun.
I'm so sorry you're so disillusioned and negative, and I remember you being...
I'm not disillusioned. Which is caused by both sides of this.